My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. This week, we are joined by the British author, Luke Phillips, to discuss Britain's ABC, that's alien big cats if you don't know, phenomena, alongside more invasive species, cryptozoology, and our mutual love of the horror author, James Herbert. We cover several famous British big cat sightings and flaps, so I've put a large selection of links to these stories in the show notes if you want to find out more about each particular case. We'll also discuss Luke's books, Shadow Beast and The Daughters of Darkness, and what the rest of the year may hold for him. Which, going on current thing, probably means self-isolation for the next few weeks. As I record this, it seems that the awful news from Europe, which continues to suffer terrible losses from the coronavirus, just seems to get worse on a daily basis. Sadly, it also seems to have launched numerous conspiracy theories on the back of this. You know, because terrible events don't need speculation adding to it to make things and people feel better about themselves. Pandemics are nothing new, so quite why anyone would want to leap to incredible conspiracy theories rather than history showing us that these things happen baffles me. Just do your bit. Stay in, wash your hands, and just stay safe. And to my friends in Italy and our listeners, resta forte Italia. Also, my deepest condolences to the family and friends of British Fortean, Anthony Conroy, who sadly passed away recently. Anthony was a kind, caring and thoughtful man who will be deeply missed by all in the Fortean world here in Britain. Take care. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook by searching for Mysteries and Monsters. We're also on Twitter and Instagram as Mystery Monsters. You can support the show by making a donation via PayPal by searching for Mysteries and Monsters. And finally, you can always drop us a line via email at mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com if you'd like to appear on the show or just drop us a line with a chat. So, as this crisis unfolds across the world, just try and focus what matters to you. Stay safe and take care of each other. Now, it's time to speak to Luke Phillips for this week's episode. My guest today is British author Luke Phillips. Luke has always had an interest in natural history. It's hard to say when that interest began to include myths and monsters that haunt our folklore, but it may well have been as a young boy standing on the shores of Loch Ness. From trekking through California looking for Bigfoot, to camping out in the highlands on the trail of real-life reported big cats, his imagination has always been captivated by the darker side of our unnatural history. Despite studying zoology at university, Luke has strayed from the mainstream into the eerie world of cryptids and monsters, and the truth may well be stranger and far scarier than fiction. His first book, Shadow Beast, was launched in 2015, and his second, The Daughters of Darkness, was released in 2017. Luke is based in Kent in the UK. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you.
Pleasure. It's always nice, especially because it's always interesting when I speak to people that I've heard on other shows, because I feel like I know you a little bit already.
No, well, as somebody who listens to the podcast, it's the same for me. I feel like I'm speaking to somebody I already know. And that's, again, that's the joy of social media as well, isn't it? You feel like you've met everybody before.
Absolutely, very much so. I was saying to someone the other week that Shannon and Into the Fray is essentially a gateway drug podcast,
Absolutely.
into so many situations, because I've met so many people or found people that have a similar slant to my thoughts in regards to cryptozoology and the paranormal through Into the Fray, that it's just taken me in. Obviously, you were on there a couple of years, well, 3 years ago, I think now, Lou, was it?
Yeah, I think it was episode 92, so I don't know what episode that would, how many, that's now, but they're approaching 500, so it must have been, a couple of years ago now at least. So yeah, so it would have been, because it would have been 2017, so because the second book had just come out. So yeah, but yes, the phrases, as Shannon calls them, or calls us as such.
Yes.
I mean, again, it's great to actually connect with people who enjoy the topic, and I don't mean the armchair sort of researchers or trolls or the that's sort of, it's people who are actually just genuinely enjoying the topic. That's where you get all the jokes, the sort of in-group sense of humor. And I think, as you say, it's a gateway podcast for everything to do with everything from the paranormal to our beloved cryptids. So
absolutely. And it's always intriguing for me as well, because I think yourself as an author, Luke, you certainly seem to be in a certain niche of cryptozoological fiction, though there is a large influence, obviously, on your work by our wonderful alleged population of ABCs. So what drew you towards this wonderful subject? What was the reason that you got hooked?
Well, it started out when I was at university. I studied zoology at University of John Moores up in Liverpool, and I basically started, as most sort of air quotes scientists do, by trying to prove that they weren't here. Because I'd obviously heard the stories. I lived in Penge, Crystal Palace, and Beckenham at the time. We'd had our own scare story of the Penge Panther, which, when you think about it, is just like, but it's the same with the Surrey Puma. All of these cats that have appeared in big built-up areas, you think, what's there? But Crystal Palace Park is, a significant green space, which has, all sorts of prey species. And again, after you dismiss it and you start looking into it, there was a police constable who was called to the main eyewitness of the Penge Panther, and he said, yeah, it was a big cat. And it's very difficult to argue with a policeman and say, no, it can't have been, don't you? They were adamant of what they had seen. And again, once you start looking into it, so as I did at university, so for instance, there was a Gloucestershire Constabulary, and it's quite famous. I think it's now done the rounds on all of the TV programs and YouTube and things like that, of police helicopter footage who were looking for an animal, that had been reported on the M4, and the infrared footage clearly shows a lynx. It's a large, long-legged feline with no tail. And it's clear as day that it's not a blob squatch. You can see exactly what it is. And then we've had, again, you start uncovering, the facts. So for instance, Felicity the Puma, which was found in 1980 in the Highlands of Cannock, which is exactly where my first book is set for that reason. There's been lynx, several lynx shots, livestock deaths. There's been, I mean, there's over 2,000 sightings a year of big cats in the UK. Now, a lot of them are mistaken identity. There's no, we've all seen the videos of what look like very large cats, and there is a feral cat population, and people don't realize how big feral cats can be. But 2,000, sightings a year, it only takes one of them to be right, and Yeah, and I know that's a phrase that many investigators use, but 2,000 people a year cannot be lying, you know. And when you talk to officials like the police, like, you know, military personnel and things like that, who are confirming what these people are seeing, then you have to really start taking it a little bit more seriously and not dismissing it quite as much. And it's interesting because when I've mentioned what I do at work, for instance, you know, I work for a company where there's about 250 of us. I mentioned what I do very casually. In that time, two people have come up to me and said, I've seen one. You know, so, and that's, you know, in you know, as I say, in Kent, in the Garden of England, which is a big cat hotspot. So, yeah, it basically started out as a little side project at university, me thinking, well, this will be easy. I can put this to bed and, you know, prove that they're not here. And 23 years later.
Yes. I mean, that's the thing as well. I mean, was there a point, Luke, when, you know, as you say, your grounding is in you know, the bricks and mortar of real zoology, without wishing to dismiss, as I'm sure anybody who listens to the programme, I certainly don't, I'm not dismissive of cryptozoology in the slightest. But was there a certain point when you just thought, I'm not too sure about some of these stories? There's a lot more to them.
I think it took a lot. Well, there was, it took, I was always sceptical right up until I had an encounter myself, or I had two encounters myself, which basically, you know, made me think, you know, well, what do you do about that? Because you're either just, you know, you're now in that situation that everybody else is in, that, you know, do you question what you've seen, or do you trust yourself? And, you know, the first encounter I had, which was, you know, several years ago now, I was living in Sevenoaks in Kent. I was coming back from a friend's house in Tunbridge. There is a very steep hill quite close to the National Trust property of Knoll Park. Yes. And Knoll Park is a very expansive deer park. They've got fallow deer there. They've got seeker deer. You know, so, you know, lovely, you know, huge territory. And basically, as I was coming back up this hill before it just gets to the property, three deer ran across the road. I absolutely slammed on the brakes and went to get going again, and a very large black shape passed in front of the headlights and immediately knew what I'd seen. You know, it was a large black cat. It had, you know, ears close to the skull. It had a long tail that was using balances streaked across. It didn't care I was there. It certainly avoided me. It knew where the shadows were. It had all of the, it showed all of the instinctive behavior of a predator. You know, and I knew immediately what I'd seen. I questioned what I'd seen for a very long time. But when I did phone the police and said, look, I'm just reporting this, please don't, you know, I was expecting a huge argument and some dismissive nonsense. You know, and again, that particular cat about, well, I don't know if it was that particular cat, but 3 years later, we had a huge spat of sightings of what became known as the Knoll Park Panther. You know, and there were reported livestock deaths at the at Knoll Park of deer. So,
I mean, I've long been intrigued by stories of ABCs in the United Kingdom. Primarily, most people outside of the UK are going to have heard of one more than any other, which is the Beast of Bodmin.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which always, despite having zero connection with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and the Hound of the Baskervilles, has always reminded me as a wonderful potential for a story about Sherlock Holmes as some kind of parallel sequel to The Hound.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and there are, again, it's just that area of the country. It's the, you know, the fact that it's probably the most famous one because of the amount of media attention it got. You know, this is a cat that we had the army out hunting. Three snipers said they saw it but couldn't get a shot off. You know, so you had validation of the reports. You had livestock deaths. You had one particular farm which was, you know, very badly affected by it. And, you know, from, I think, you know, 78 to 81, this was an animal that was regularly in the media spotlight, you know. And, a significant amount of, you know, taxpayers' money went on trying to find the creatures, trying to find, trying to hunt it down, basically. And again, I think what's interesting is that, you know, researchers at the time identified, yes, a large black cat, but also then they found that there was a smaller sandy coloured animal that regularly travelled with it. And they identified different footprints and things like that. And again, that's significant evidence. You can't just say, oh, well, you know, they were mistaken. It was a fox. You know, when you've got people, you know, making those kind of clarifications and they're on public record, you know, that's, you know, something that you've got to start taking a bit more seriously.
The most frustrating aspect of all of this for me, Luke, is that I know enough about this subject to know how many non-native cats have been shot and killed in this country in the last 40 years.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And I find it incredible that whenever one of these stories hits the news, you know, we've touched on a couple. You've mentioned the one in Penge. You know, Gloucestershire's had a flap. Cornwall's had a flap. There was a famous one in Sydenham where a bodybuilder got attacked in his garden.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that guy was, I think, again, obviously, when you look at Sydenham and how close it is to Penge,
yep.
You know, there's, I mean, and I lived in the area at the time. Mm-hmm. I'm Beckenham born and bred. In fact, it's a really good example of why, if there is a conspiracy theory behind these animals, how people reacted to that particular cat is a good example of why there might be one. Because I had local friends who were teachers phoning up whether the school should be closed. There was a local school that was closed, you know. There were people, you know, keeping their pets in. There were, you know, people weren't going to go to the open air concert at Crystal Palace.
Yeah.
And this was all, you know, based on basically one sighting. But again, it was collaborated by the police. They said they'd seen something in his garden. Again, it can't just be dismissed. It's, you know, and these, you know, huge city parks like Crystal Palace Park, they create, you know, perfect corridors and gateways for these animals to travel upon. You know, there's a reason why, for instance, muntjac deer have invaded huge, you know, swathes of the countryside.
Yeah.
Because they've been able to travel through mainly railways, but they've actually, from the railways, they've entered, you know, city parks.
Yeah.
And that's an example of an invasive prey animal. Others include wild boar and, you know, and there's many others. So if you had an ABC, if you have a new apex predator in the ecosystem, it's going to follow the prey.
Absolutely. I mean, the incident in Sydenham is one of my favourite reported ones, because, I mean, essentially, he had a fight with this creature for 30 seconds. We're not talking about somebody glancing and seeing something that ran through the bottom of the garden or anything. And I've got friends from South East London, so I've visited that area quite a lot over the last sort of 30 years, Luke. So I know, just, I think it's one of those things people just don't think, other than the main parts like Hyde Park, they're not aware of just how green and leafy some areas of London are, especially in the southeast. You know, I know Beckenham particularly well because one of my friends is from Charlton, so I know around that area very well. A friend of mine used to live in Sydenham, so all that kind of area, around that kind of, you know, part of London, I know fairly well, and I know how green and lush certain areas are. That, and it's, you know, London's London as well. When you come to the outskirts after 11 o'clock, you don't really see many people. It's not like the inner city where it's hustle and bustle 24 hours a day.
No, don't. And, you know, it's worth remembering 47% of outer London is green space, and another 2.5% is water.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that, you know, nearly 50% of our capital city is basically, you know, prime wildlife habitat. It's a significant green space. There aren't actually many cities on earth like London when it comes to the green space it offers. We're very wildlife orientated. There are lots of wildlife corridors. And as you say, Sydenham has these huge avenues of tree lined, Victorian roads. There's significant railways. There's, you know, lots of tunnels. There's lots of, you know, if you were an apex predator with, you know, millennia of instincts, you could hide no problem.
I mean, one of the strangest excuses I've ever heard to completely dismiss the potential of any kind of big cat living in the UK was, famously, it was either too wet or too cold for big cats to survive in, as if big cats only live in Africa and India. And I just find that incredible, when the first thing that came to my mind was, well, have you never heard of a Siberian tiger?
No, exactly.
Well, I mean, what?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, there are certain aspects of our environment that, so certain animals like a lion or a tiger, even a Muir tiger or Siberian tiger, you know, they would probably find our climate slightly difficult, but depending on what species they were, because as you say, there are, if it was an Muir tiger, which just happens to be the largest species cat in the world, they might survive a little bit easier than a Sumatran or a Bengal. But if you look at the two types of cats that are regularly reported, so one being the black panther as such, so, and obviously panther is a generic term. What we're actually referring to is a melanistic animal, you know, an animal that's got a black pigment skin, so probably a leopard, but could also refer to a jaguar. There's actually been studies of melanism in all cat species, and there is a potential that just no matter what the species of cat, it's estimated that roughly 1 in 10,000 animals are probably going to be black, unless there are population animals. So, for instance, there are a population in Sri Lanka of leopards who are almost predominantly black, because it suits their environment better. And again, if you go to South America and you go to the Mato Grosso, there is a population there of jaguars which are predominantly black, and they also seem to have shorter tails as well, which is interesting. And it's an environmental adaptation. So, but what is interesting is that genetically speaking, black cats have better immune systems, and they are much more likely to survive, because obviously they're much more likely to unlikely to be seen. They've got an advantage when hunting at night, and all of those sort of evolutionary benefits. So it's no surprise that black cats, you know, do well, particularly in the right environment. But when you look at leopards and the black melanistic leopard and mountain lions, the sandy coloured animals that are reported in the UK, we're talking about the two most adaptive species of cat in the world. Leopards are found right across from Europe, the same Siberian area of Russia and China, right across Europe to the across Asia into Africa, into the Middle East. Leopards are found absolutely everywhere. And when you look at the mountain lion is found from Alaska right down to the tip of the Andes in South America. There isn't an environment that those two cats cannot conquer. So to simply suggest that we, who've got a fairly convenient mid-range climate, and also we've got everything from mountain peaks to, coastal brush and desert, we can accommodate a big cat very happily. And it's also worth remembering that until very recently, we did have native species of big cats. Up until 400 years ago, we did have the lynx. Up until 10,000 years ago, we had, quite serious big cats. We had Homotherium, which was a full saber-toothed cat. We had the European jaguar. We had the European leopard. We had cave lions. Over the years, we've had some serious fauna. I mean, it's only relatively recently, speaking geologically, that we've lost them. So,
yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it is one of those things, and I think it's probably, especially when we're talking about such subjects as mystery cryptids, that one of the most overly used quotes is "Nature will find a way."
And it
always does, and it still surprises me, Luke, that there are certain skeptical aspects towards nature that they completely disregard anything. And I mean, you've only got to go to Florida to understand that there's not a lot of places that if a certain species can adapt quickly enough, they can survive almost anywhere.
Well, exactly. I mean, Florida, which is a gateway into America for the exotic pet trade.
Yes.
They have had so many different types of animal species escape, particularly when they've been hit by hurricanes and flooding.
Yep.
So you've now got all sorts of issues with, everything from reticulated pythons to agama lizards to types of exotic bird, and you name it. I mean, Florida really has, got, I mean, we think we've got problems when it comes to invasive species like, the gray squirrel and things like that. Florida is, as always seems to be the case for Florida, is go big or go home. So they've absolutely won when it comes to invasive species problems and not controlling them. So
I think one of the things that once surprised me the most of strange animals that live in Florida is the cane rat.
Oh yeah.
Which if you've never seen, I mean, anybody that's afraid of mice and rats, normal ones, God knows what they'd think if they came across one of those. And I remember seeing some footage of a group of them around bins, and they were just enormous.
They are, yeah. I mean, it's again, one of my favourite books is James Herbert's The Rat.
Yes, the first horror book I ever read. I was 9. They,
I think there is a scene in my book, The Shadow Beast, which pays homage to the rats, because there is a school scene basically. Just because, like you say, I think it was probably one of the first horror monster books I read, and I just was transfixed. But when they talk about the rats in the original rats that the breed of, they were from Sumatra, and they were basically what he was describing was a cane rat. With these formidable incisors and absolutely. If you're scared of rats, do not look up cane rats. You are not you won't be sleeping for a while.
Absolutely. And there's also Peter Jackson, the wonderful New Zealand film director, his film is it Brain Dead?
Oh yes.
With the, now that's, isn't that zombie rat from Sumatra?
They are basically, yeah, exactly right, yeah.
And I think, and I'm not sure who he was homaging there, whether he was homaging Herbert or, do you see where I'm coming from with that? Because it plays on two things, that.
It does, yeah. No, it's interesting because given how old the rats is, I would say I would like to think he was, but I know Peter Jackson is a prolific reader, so it could have been him, or it could be Ramiro, or let's hope it's Herbert. So
yes, absolutely. Well, wouldn't surprise me in the least. I mean, James Herbert is one of those who we sadly lost a couple of years ago. For me, he's one of those authors that I think he's not perhaps as well known as he should be, really, for probably our most prolific modern horror writer.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he wrote some really stunning books. I mean, as I said, the first two Rats books, The Rats and Lair, Domain, I didn't get on quite so well because the zombies turn up in Domain. Great books. But Lair, which interestingly enough is set in a deer park. Again, it really captured the essence and the fear factor that, for instance, we see with big cats today. But he wrote a beautiful fairy tale called Once, which was lovely. And Fluke, which I know got made into a movie. As you say, one of our best, best writers, really. And yeah, as you say, not as famous as he deserves, as he should be, really.
Yeah, I think he suffers from, in the vast majority of his work, that he's had some really bad film versions. And I think the only one that probably stands up to The Fog.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, The Fog is terrific. But again, I think it's something about the early 80s and horror movies. That's when they were last doing them properly. And I know a lot of people get annoyed when I say that, but there is something about the 80s, the original 80s Fog that is very good. And again, as you say, he has unfortunately paid the price with some terrible movies of the books. So
yes, especially Rats.
Oh yeah.
which I recommend both as a horror completist and also a lover of really bad horror films. That,
absolutely. I mean, the resemblance it bears to the book is laughable. But yes, it's got to. I mean, again, I think was it. I can't remember one of the. I think it was 28 Days Later had paid a little homage to, because there was a scene with a tunnel and lots of rats, and that was a homage to James Herbert. So it's interesting that he's clearly influenced a lot of people in the field, and it's just a shame that for instance, films like The Rats haven't to date been done justice. So
I think he struggled because King's had a lot of bad films made from his work. However, two or three of the early ones were really rather good, which are Carrie and Christine. And I think that kind of lessens the damage of some of the later work, like The Lawnmower Man bears no resemblance to the story at all. if you're talking about artistic license, Luke, that's one of the worst examples ever.
Oh, it's terrible. You're talking about Christine there, because as well as being a conservationist, I'm a petrolhead, which is slightly ironic. But let's see what you can really do. Is one of the best scenes in cinema, where Christine just builds herself in the garage. But again, Stephen King hated The Shining, but it's now considered one of the icons of cinema, and obviously with the recent success King is seeing with It and Mr. Mercedes and things like that, clearly he's back into it. Although again, one of the films he doesn't like, which I actually think is hilarious, is Silver Bullet.
Yes, I love Silver Bullet.
It's one of my absolute favourites. Just to see a werewolf clutching a baseball bat. I'll forgive it anything, really. So it's
absolutely. It is one of those films that really you can see the plot twist coming from about 5 minutes in.
Yeah, it's not. We're not. we're not talking one of the most literary of twists and storytelling, but it's enjoyable nonetheless for that reason. So
very much so. So was it? As you say, as we've kind of digressed a little bit into our mutual love of bad versions of our favourite horror authors' films, what was it that made you make the leap from studying big cats and your background in zoology, Luke, to taking the leap to become an author? Then was it, what was the catalyst in regards to that?
Well, to a certain extent, it was talking about Stephen King. A bit of a challenge that he wrote, he sort of threw down in one of his books on writing, which was, if you can't find a book that you want to read, write it. And that was very much what, I just felt that when, I'd talked to so many witnesses, I'd talked to, authority figures, I'd spoken to the police, I'd contacted DEFRA, spoken to people who'd seen them. I'd been out on the moors, talking about my second encounter, I'd been in dark Dartmoor, and we had, you know, played sound recordings of a Puma, only to get something, you know, call back, and then we had, you know, the carnivore keeper at Exmoor Zoo, you know, confirmed to us. He said that he had seen a leopard himself, and that he said that the leopards that are at Exmoor Zoo regularly get, you know, how can you, I put it, courted or called to, you know, from outside the zoo. So, you know, what do you explain it? But basically, it got to the point where I thought there is a story to be told here. There is, I'd always loved writing when I was at school. My English teachers encouraged me to write, but I was dead set on being a vet at the time. And when I didn't get the grades, I was then dead set on being a zoologist. To a certain extent, I think all these things happen for a reason. And if I hadn't gone to university and studied zoology, I would never have had the background that I now do to write the books. You know, I wouldn't have the knowledge. I wouldn't have done the research. I wouldn't have met the people that I have met in the industry or in the field, you know, who have given me these incredible witness accounts, who have given me these stories, who feel happy to come up to me at talks and tell me that they've had an experience, you know, not just with big cats, you know. I've had everything reported to me from, you know, Bigfoot to, you know, people reporting dragons and fairies. So, yes. And as I say, some of those I'm yet to be convinced on, but that doesn't mean I don't listen. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. And whenever I've spoken to anybody that's started a career in either personal interest or professionally, when it deals with cryptids, is that they, regardless of the subject they tend to specialize in, they seem to find themselves attracting stories for, as you touch on there, some things that really push the boundaries of both credence and zoological knowledge.
Yeah, oh, without a doubt. I mean, it's, I think if you'd asked me 10 years ago, you know, Luke, do you think there's any chance of there being, you know, big cats in the UK, I would have said yes, absolutely, not a problem, I believe in that, there's this reason. And if that question had been followed up with what about Bigfoot, I would have probably dismissed it. You know, and probably a little arrogantly. I don't think I would have, and again, if somebody had said what about werewolves, you know, one of my, as we mentioned, probably one of my favorite, you know, movie monsters,
yes,
again, I would have said no, absolutely no chance. Surely these things don't exist. But, you know, a little bit later on, you know what? People are, in fact, you know, as I say, I live in Kent. I don't live too far from the village of Yalding, which has had both Bigfoot and, you know, what we, you know, I hate the term, and I know Shannon hates the term, and I know pretty much anyone who deals with them hates the term. But, you know, for want of another word, you know, has Dogman has been reported. So, and again, I can't, it's not fair of me to say that I'm happy to look into big cats, which most people don't think are here, and then dismiss people who say, well, actually, what I saw was, you know, 7 foot tall and looks a bit like an ape man, or, you know, a Neanderthal, or a werewolf.
Yeah, I mean, Dogman as the term that nobody seems to really like, but then nobody wants to say werewolf either. I think, Luke, I think you're stuck between a rock and a hard place with this one.
It does. I mean, it's interesting because when I've done a little bit of research, because I've got a book that is a work in progress that is you know, where basically one of these creatures will make an appearance, and trying to get Native Americans to talk about it, you know, I mean, if you want to talk about people who take it seriously,
yes,
you know, the Native American nations really, really do. Because I thought it can't be that hard, because I didn't want to call it Dogman, I didn't want to call it this. So I was like, there must be a Native American name I can use that will be, you know, and it really is a subject matter they're not really willing to trivialize at all. And the moment I said I was working on fiction, they were less interested because it was almost they almost saw it as disrespect. Yes. So I'm working on some angles on that, but that was a really a real wake up call for me about how serious some people take this. And obviously, you know, when you listen to, you know, Vic Cundiff's dog man encounters and things like that, there are clearly people are seeing something that, and as you say, some people are very, very clear on what they've seen. Mm. It can't be a case of mistaken identity. So, and again, I think I've mentioned to Shannon before, but there are aspects that get my scientific strokes, you know, my zoology brain interested. So, you know, for instance, when a lot of people, you know, when they mention this creature moving up from four limbs to two, so when it goes from being a quadruped to a biped, they talk about this popping of the joints, or this popping noise as it stands up. Mm. Now, that's very unlikely to be bone, because obviously that would be extremely painful. And
yes.
But it sounds like a bit like when you crack your knuckles, it's some kind of synaptic fluid popping as it sort of repositions itself, which makes a lot of sense. But if you're making this stuff up, that's a very strange detail to imagine. Mm. Yeah, and I've got a good imagination. Well, I hope I have, because I'm a writer. So it's for somebody to come up with that level of detail, I think is very strange. And again, that lends it a little bit of credibility, because that is a biological process that they're describing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things I've always thought that more people don't pick on about the Patterson-Gimlin film, because it's got breasts.
Is absolutely
right. If you're going to make it up, at what point does somebody say, "I'll tell you what will convince everybody. Let's give it breasts."
Yeah, and not to mention what looks like a hernia.
Yes.
This is the other thing as well when it comes to the Patterson-Gimlin film as well, is that people do not realise where in California that was shot and how inhospitable that environment was, and how difficult it was at the time to get to. Mm. You know, there is a reason, you know, Patterson had to ask Bob Giblin, a seasoned horseman, you know, to get him in there, because nothing else could get there, and it took 3 days as it was. It's not just round the corner and off the trail. That was deep woods at the time. So the likelihood that they got a big heavy suit up there, and then they thought, do you know what, it needs breasts, and if you could make it look like it's got muscles moving under the skin and you've got a hernia. Mm. I mean, as Walt Disney said at the time, we couldn't do that. And they were the best special effects studio of the late 60s. And they said they couldn't do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I've always pointed out, the other aspect of that is probably the most famous direct comparison is the year after Planet of the Apes was released.
And absolutely.
They all look like people dressed up as monkeys.
Yeah, and again, but it's even things like the compliant gait, you know.
Yes.
There are so many aspects of that film which just make, you know, either they were basically geniuses, and I think even if it was a hoax, there is absolutely no way Bob Gimlin was in on it. Patterson, yes, I know he had a bit of a background, and I know there was notebooks and things like that, but this was a guy who was genuinely looking for the animal. But even if it was a hoax, and which I don't think it was, the amount of planning and basically genius level detail that would have gone into that, I just don't think Patterson was capable of that. And I don't mean that in a dismissive way. I just, he was a guy who was certainly out to make a buck, but we're not talking about an evil genius or anything. Yeah, and it just coming up with a whole different way of the animal walking, coming up with the details like breasts, coming up with that level, that a suit that good. You know, and I know who was the guy who said he was in the suit? Was it Hieronymus Bob?
Yes, yes. The guy offered $100,000 to provide it, and he suddenly disappeared.
He suddenly disappeared, and then when asked if he could find the location, couldn't get back to it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, stuff like that gets sort of forgotten by history. And you talk to people about the Patterson and Gimlin film, and people go, oh, it's just a hoax, isn't it? And you sort of let out this big sigh and go, right, well, let me walk you through it. And so, as you say, there's these biological aspects of the film, biological aspects of the sightings of a lot of these animals, where you think, you know, and a lot of the time the people who are seeing them don't know a great deal about wildlife. Mm. So the likelihood of them picking up on these things or, you know, making them up is very, very, very slim.
Yeah.
You know, you need a lot of detailed knowledge to be able to, you know, come up with what they've described.
Yeah. I think there are two branches from what you've said there, Luke, in regards to the Patterson Gimlin film. And I want to address both of them, because both of them, I think, kind of answer certain allegations and sceptical points towards the film and the people behind it. If they were that good at special effects, you know, why are they mucking about in the woods? These guys could write their own checks in Hollywood.
Right? Absolutely. They could have gone to any studio at the time
and
shown what they could have done, and they would have been made for the rest of their lives.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right? So that's that aspect. Because if I was that good, I know what I'd be doing. I wouldn't be running around the middle of Bluff Creek.
No, of course not. And I wouldn't be going around to individual cinemas trying to sell the film for years and years and years afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. And the second aspect is that people say, well, they were only in it for the money, right? Are you honestly telling me that anybody who's searching for cryptid, a missing cryptid, be it an abominable snowman, Orang Pendek, the Yowie, any of them, do you think if they can prove it, they're going to give that research away for free, or that proof for free? Of course they're not. Anybody who captures conclusive proof of any alleged cryptid, be it, you know, the thylacine, a prime example, anybody that finally produces something of that is set for the rest of their life.
Oh, 100%. And I think, and it's interesting, because I think the thylacine is one of the animals we are much, of all the ones we might find, I think the thylacine is the one that is closest.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I do think that we are going to find populations in Queensland, and I think we're going to find populations in Tasmania as well.
Yeah.
And perhaps the two different subspecies, you know, the larger and the smaller. I really do think that, you know, in our lifetime, we are going to rediscover the thylacine. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those. I think it's, you know, it's iconic around the world as an image of both man's naivety and ignorance. I think, you know, essentially, it was cleansing on a scale we probably aren't, but it probably went on. I mean, I've seen pictures from America and Canada in the, you know, the late 19th century, some of the wolf slaughterings that went on, and they are terrifying pictures where you've literally got hundreds of carcasses just piled up.
Oh, absolutely. And the some of the things that were done in the, particularly in America in the 19th century, I mean, you've still got states today which have got bounties on certain predator skins.
Mm.
And again, it's one of those things as a zoologist or and as a conservationist that make my blood boil, because you know, the arrogance that we show when we say stupid things like that, you know, wolves, for instance, are decimating the deer population and things like that, you know, shows a fundamental disrespect and disregard of predator prey relationships, because that's not how they work. You know, predators decline with the deer. Predators go up with the population increase of the deer.
Yes.
There is a harmony between predator and prey.
Mm-hmm.
There always is. There's only one animal, and you know, it's one of those interesting things that, you know, when Agent Smith in The Matrix describes, you know, the human beings as a parasite, he's not far off, because we are one of the only species in the sorry, I'll get off my soapbox in a minute.
It's all right.
Is that where that will willingly disregard, you know, the abundance of prey. You know, and you know, there is only, you know, who wrote A Whale for Killing? He's a great naturalist. I can't remember now. But he wrote a book on wolves, and he basically was answering the accusations that wolves were killing all the caribou. And of course, he went up into Alaska. He spent, you know, months on end studying them. Mm. And lo and behold, the only things that were killing the caribou were men.
Yep.
You know, it was, and again, we continue to do it. It's, you know, we wipe out all of our predators, and then we wonder why ecosystems are out of kilts. You know, In the Way of the Wolf, which is one of my favourite books on conservation, it's about the reintroduction of wolves into Yellowstone.
Yes.
And there is a beautiful quote in it, which again, I borrowed from one of my books, which is he describes wolves as the painters of mountains. Mm. Which is, and what he means is, what he goes on to describe is that basically, the wolves, when they were reintroduced into Yellowstone, you had these very confident deer and elk herds who could have spent, you know, the last few decades browsing and eating whatever they like, whenever they want, without fear of being hunted. And then suddenly, with the introduction of the wolves, they suddenly had to start taking on more natural prey behavior. So they could only eat at dawn and dusk. They wouldn't go out in the open. They would have to retreat to the tree line during the day and things like that. And suddenly wildflower meadows started popping up all over Yellowstone. When there were trees and shrubs were able to start growing around waterways again, which then meant that beavers started coming back into Yellowstone. This is what we mean when we talk about an apex predator. This is what we mean, because they have complete control. They are keystone species that basically have this huge important role to play in an ecosystem. They don't just eat your animals. They're not a nuisance. They actually are a way of controlling natural populations. And they do it way better than we do, you know. You know, you and I, for instance, we've both live in areas which have been affected by flooding. Now, how much flooding would we see if, for instance, beavers were more prominent in the UK? Where beavers have been reintroduced in Scotland and in the West Country, suddenly they're seeing less flooding. There are huge benefits to having a natural and balanced ecosystem which has predators and prey. But in the UK, we did away with all of our apex predators a long time ago. And it's interesting that now we've got these ABCs that we're seeing, you know, perhaps a few things that, you know, for instance, Yellowstone would recognise. So where we had, you know, huge spikes in the deer population, we're seeing the numbers come down a little bit. It's interesting.
It is. I mean, it is as well, especially in the UK, because, you know, for most people, I don't think they're really aware of, because, you know, as we touched on earlier, Florida is known around the world for the amount of invasive species that love living there, alongside all the tourists and the retirees. But, you know, here in the UK, we've got three invasive species that, unless people saw them, I don't think you'd believe that. You know, we've got the wallabies that have made the way up and down the UK. I think there's a population in down south. There's one on the moors in North Yorkshire. And they're also on the Isle of Man.
They are, Isle of Man. There's one not far. Hampshire, I think, has got a population of wallabies. And again, they are spreading a little bit. But yeah, as you say, Yorkshire's got them. I'm sure Chester had them as well. But when you think,
I was going to say, you know, you've got those guys, you've got the hog population that's ripping up the Forest of Dean.
Absolutely, and most of Kent. We've got Boar in Pembury, in Tunbridge, across Kent. I mean, I drove down the A21 not too long ago, and there is just south of Tunbridge Wells towards Hastings, there is a big patch between Tunbridge and Bedgebury, and there is basically what looks like a harvested field along the the road there, and it's bore activity. They've been digging up the soil there. Bore, and again, you can't ask for a better prey species than wild boar.
Yeah, absolutely. And my favourite weird invasive species is Norfolk's capybaras, which I didn't even realise till a couple of years ago. I was like, what? Where have they come from?
No, absolutely. and again, they've now also been reported in Gloucestershire. So because I think they were at the Cotswolds, Cotswolds Water Park or National, and they had escapees there. So but we've got, those are our three sort of most interesting ones, but almost everything, a lot of the animals we see every day are invasive species. So, the obvious one being the North American grey squirrel. That is an invasive species.
Yeah.
UK never had any natural species of rabbits, or hare. We had one species of hare, which was the mountain hare.
Yeah.
That's a native species. But the rabbit and the brown hare are invaders from Europe, which both of which were brought over by the Normans and the Romans. So, we've got all sorts of things here if it shouldn't be here. So,
And obviously
Chinese water deer.
Yes. Well, near where I live in Sheffield, we've got a flourishing population of Chinese ducks.
Right. Yeah.
And they're beautiful.
Yeah. When it comes to the, and it's interesting because obviously with global warming, we're now seeing other species like cattle egret come over. Things like that, but yes, the amount of things that escape from parks and that have escaped from collections and things like that, and that's the other thing as well that people don't, when people are talking about the big cats and things, the amount of animals that are in private hands, even today, the amount of people who are given licenses for basically dangerous animals, is shocking, really. I don't know if I think it was only a few years ago as well. And this is the other thing, is how they get here. And to give you an example, a few years ago, I was in Portsmouth because I was going to go on a whale watching cruise in the Bay of Biscay. But I was in Portsmouth the evening before. I was just having a walk around the jetty, I'd gone to see the HMS Victory, and I was just walking around, and there was a guy walking his air quotes dog, and I just clapped eyes on it, and I went, in my head, the narrator went, that's a timber wolf. I was a bit sheepish, and I thought, it can't be. And then, and I'm like, no, trust yourself, that's a timber wolf. So I walked over and, made a bit of small talk because we were both looking up at, HMS Victory. And, he was actually an American chap. And then, I made polite small talk. I went, I've got to ask. I said, you've got a timber wolf. And he went, and he denied it a couple of times. I went, look, I'm really sorry. I said, I studied zoology at university. I know my animals, particularly mammals. I said, it's a wolf. And he chuckled and he went, all right, it is a wolf. But he got it in through Heathrow, listed as a German Shepherd. he bought it in America as a pet.
Yeah.
Kept it as a pet. Yeah, because obviously in America, depending on the state, you can do that. And came over here, and brought it with him.
Yeah.
And he said, and I obviously asked, the question. I said, well, is he friendly? Does he like to be stroked? And she said, well, likes an interesting word.
Tolerate.
That's exactly how he put it. He said, he tolerates it. I went, all right, well, I'll risk it then, But I mean, and again, it was interesting because as I walked over to him, you know, this, you know, the fact that it was a German Shepherd was just nonsense because, you know, this thing clocked me with amber eyes.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, when I started out, you know, many years ago, as I was when I was studying for my A levels, I worked as a veterinary nurse, and I was lucky enough to do some volunteering work up at the Metropolitan Police Dog School.
Yes.
So I'm very familiar with German Shepherds. I don't like, and they don't have amber eyes that give you the chills as you walk across the courtyard towards them. You know, that's something you get when you are in. You know, again, it's sort of that natural instinct that sort of that you get when you're in the presence of a predator.
Yeah, I mean, it nothing surprises me. I once went away golfing, and we went out at on the Saturday evening, and I met a couple with a pet raccoon.
Right. Yeah.
You know, at the British seaside, who loved real ale and pork scratchings.
Wow. Okay.
And he was very nice, very friendly. Well, hand fed him, had a stroke and a tickle. Gorgeous.
Yeah. But again, they were relatively popular pets. And again, when we talk about invasive species, Germany now has quite a significant problem.
Berlin, especially, doesn't it?
With raccoons. It's interesting. I've had several reports from the town of Rye, which is down on the coast here, where they've had people saying they've seen raccoons. Now, and I don't know if they're raccoons or they're raccoon dogs.
Yes.
That have maybe escaped or you know, otherwise. Mm. But you know, people are reporting raccoons. So.
Yeah, and once again, another hardy species that's very adaptable.
Absolutely. You know, they live in forests or towns, again, right up and down, you know, the United States. You know, they are a very adaptable animal, and one that, as Berlin proves, gets on very well in urban environments. So.
Absolutely. I remember I went to Florida 2004, and we were staying outside of Orlando in a complex. So we used to be out most of the day, and we'd stop off for food somewhere and just be stunned at how cheap everything was. And I remember we used to get back about 11 o'clock at night, so it was just, you know, it was fairly dark. There was still a bit of twilight kicking about, and the whole area would be littered with raccoons everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere, you know, you could probably count in half a mile from turning off and driving to the villa, I'd probably say 50 or 60 I saw.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
I'm not surprised at all. And again, when I was in California, by far and away the most common animal I saw, it was, yeah, if it wasn't raccoons, it was chipmunks.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was doing a road trip right up the coast of California, and pretty much I would regularly stop at a picnic stop or pull in. I'd, you know, sit down, grab my lunch, and you know, within a few minutes, and it happened. And the further north I went, the more common it was. I would be joined by chipmunks and raccoons who were, you know, quite intent on taking your lunch. You know. I have no trouble. Again, they're one of those animals that just acclimatise. They lose their fear of, you know, they habituate to people very, very quickly. And again, they've got the brain size, and they've got, they've got the equipment in terms of their paws and to get into all sorts of trouble and make the most of opportunities. So.
Absolutely. They are like, cheeky drunk nephews, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Raccoons.
They're very cute, they're very strange, but they're deceivingly clever, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like the idea of them being, you know, I know that in America they're fondly called trash pandas.
But, yes, that's a wonderful name.
which is fantastic. They're mischief makers, but again, it's that that cunning that we see in, because they're an offshoot of the weasel family, so badgers, otters, wolverines, that sort of stuff. They're all very, very clever animals, and they have to be. They're inquisitive, they're problem solvers. And it's interesting. So if they were able to make their way into the wild, like so many of these animals have, would they survive? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And again, it comes down to, with ABCs, people talk about, 1976 and the Dangerous Wild Animals Act being when it all started. It wasn't. We had circuses and traveling shows in the 1800s. We had traveling shows in the 15th, 16th, and 17th century. We had the Romans bring animals here, we get escapees today in the 2000s. If you're telling me that they didn't have escapees in the a 1,000 years ago and 400, 500, 600 years ago, they absolutely did. And there are reports, right back to the 15th century of spotted leopards in the English countryside. You've got to ask yourself where those animals came from. This all started a long, long time ago. It wasn't just 1976. That 100% had a massive impact. There was without a doubt a huge population surge at the time, which I imagine is why we are seeing as many sightings and reportings as we are today. But they haven't just been here for the last 40 years. They've been here for centuries.
I mean, there was a very famous incident at the beginning of the 20th century where there was a reports of livestock being killed, sheep primarily, sheep and goats, and that ended up being a Canadian lynx. And nobody knew where that come. They assumed it was a pet, but nobody came forward, nobody could prove it was a pet, and it was devastating local livestock. And that was 1903. I think
that's exactly right. And again, there were two shot in Scotland in the 1970s, and again they presumed they were pets. Felicity the Puma was presumed to be a pet because she was very tame and she got on. She didn't seem to be scared of people. But and again, the lynx was assumed to be pets. And the fact that there was livestock killings suggests that probably was the case, because animals that aren't used to hunting prey do tend to go for livestock. But again, there was no proof. Nobody ever came forward. And it's worth pointing out, it wasn't until 1981 that it actually became illegal to release animals into the wild. So in 1976 they passed the Dangerous Wild Animals Act, but they didn't bother making it illegal to release a dangerous wild animal until 1981. So you wouldn't have even, if you did have a lion and let it loose on the, you wouldn't have been gotten into trouble, unless it was 1981 or beyond. It's, it makes a mockery of it, really. It's, when you think about it, we laugh, but it's terrifying when you think, One of the reasons that I write fiction is because you hear so many wonderful stories which you can't substantiate or prove. But the stories of these rich personal collectors who when they went down, when the inspectors went downstairs and found all the cages empty and open, absolute delight. So I was like, that's the sort of story dreams are made of, but again, the people there, we know that there are, these animals were being bought, regularly from shops like Harrods. They were being walked in the streets, there's everything from a guy who bought a lion, to keep his his scrap metal business safe.
Yep.
And the line from Harrods, which was a famous story.
Wonderful story. That's very. It's lovely. A tearjerker. Christian the Lion. It's beautiful.
It is, and again, it shows that, and it does show that the intelligence, the emotional intelligence that these animals have, which does lend a, does play a part in whether they would be likely to survive or not, because they have the brain matter that allows them to live and adapt and form friendships, form alliances, that sort of thing, which is, there's a reason why, for instance, going back to the Beast of Bodmin, two species of cat that were probably working together, probably in all likelihood there was a puma and a leopard hunting together, probably relatively soon after being released, I suspect. But
Well, absolutely. We see it time and again that there is this kind of relationship, interspecies relationships, which often defies belief. And we've seen it on every continent involving every species, I think, Luke.
Yeah. I think I can't remember which one it was, but there was a recent, I'm just trying to look it up here because I made a note. There was, I think it was the Stroud Deer Eater, which is a great name for a cat.
Brilliant.
Where they did DNA testing on it. Now, the BBC were involved.
Oh, and, yes.
And it's one of those conspiracy stories which, I'll repeat here because why not? It's entertaining, but again, it's difficult to find the proof. But so the story goes that the BBC were really interested in it. They did testing in the UK, and it came back as dog.
Yeah,
they said it was dog attack. Now, what's interesting about that particular kill is that it shows absolutely no signs of a dog attack. Mm. Every aspect of that carcass was, basically the stomach had been opened up. The rib bones had been sheared through in a straight line, so snipped through by the carnassial teeth of the cat.
Yep.
So basically, when you look at a cat kill, it's very clean, and it almost looks like a scissor cut.
Yep.
Because they basically don't have any molars or premolars or incisors to do the hard work. So when a cat eats, it literally cuts off chunks and swallows.
Mm.
They don't chew their food, they cut off these lumps of food. But one of the things that cats do love to do, because they've got the dentition to do it, is they will break into bones and they will, feast on the marrow. They love marrow bone. But what you'll see is these very neat, it looks like somebody's gone through the rib cage with a cutting shears. And that's exactly what the Stroud Deer Eater looked like. And then the flip side of that is, if you've ever seen livestock, and I've seen plenty of livestock that has been attacked by dogs.
Yeah.
Dogs and bears in particular eat on the go.
Yeah.
So they don't care about you being dead, and they certainly don't care about table manners. So you're normally looking at very, very mutilated carcasses. You're normally looking at very messy kills.
Yeah.
Literally torn to pieces. That is the, the typical dog or bear kill. The difference between that and a cat kill are normally very, very obvious, and the Stroud Deer Eater as such, that Stroud deer carcass, that showed no signs of being fed on by dogs. But the official thing came back by canine. Now, what's interesting is, allegedly, further samples were then sent to a lab in the Netherlands, and they came back suggesting that it was a hybridized cat. And again, obviously, when you think about the potential population of these cats in the UK, the likelihood is that we are looking at hybridization, because there just wouldn't be enough animals for there to be a separate population of melanistic leopards and a separate population of pumas and a separate population of jungle cats, or you know, whatever you want it, you know, whatever it is. So the likelihood that there is hybridization going on is very, very strong. So it's interesting when you get these reports of these relatively strange looking animals. So there's been reports in Cambridgeshire of basically what look like giant house cats, but they have all of the movement and hallmarks of a big cat. But you know, and if you introduced hybridization into the conspiracy, then obviously that could explain a lot of the things that people see.
Yeah, I mean, because even on a domestic cat level, servals have become quite popular as luxury pets.
Yeah, and savannah cats, you know, which are only one sats, you know, one crossbreed down from a wild serval.
Yes.
You know, and if you meet a generation one savannah cat, they are basically servals. They retain a great deal of their wild behavior. They're very playful. They want to hunt, they want to jump. I've spent time with generation one savannah cats, and you know, they're I mean, personally, I don't think they should be pets, but it's because again, I don't see any difference between that and keeping a serval. But I'm sure there are savannah cat owners up and down the country in uproar, again, cats are one of those things. Cats are responsible for $300 million wildlife deaths a year. So the one thing we don't need to introduce is one that's even better at killing animals, and particularly birds and small rodents. But it's the 2020s, and we still haven't learned. We still want designer animals based on wildlife.
It is a fascinating thing. I don't know whether it's some kind of primeval throwback that we have to try and domesticate new species of wild animals to some kind of, I've seen people around the world who have kept some of the most terrifying animals as pets. I know there are several people that keep alligators as pets and pet them. I'm in awe of all animals. I think animals are incredible, but I would not, I don't care if I raised it from a hatchling, there is no way on God's earth I'd ever consider an alligator be anything close to knowing what domesticity is.
Oh no, when it comes to reptiles and things like that, I just don't get it, because there is that predatory instinct, but also the kinship that we form with a mammal, for instance, that aspect of companionship, enjoying company and things like that. It's very hard to say if the reptile brain is equipped for that. I would suggest that it isn't. It's only something we've really seen in higher mammals. And given the reptilian brain is very different, it's very unlikely that they have those, that they can feel those same things, that they can see us as anything other than a potential meal,
I've had the privilege of looking after reptiles over the years, and bearded dragons are a very inquisitive creature, but I wouldn't want to put my finger in its mouth, despite the fact that it liked to sit on me and have its tummy tickled.
Yeah, absolutely. and obviously I'm not dismissive, because I know there are many, for instance, snake owners, but again, we can't misinterpret inquisitiveness and curiosity. Plus, hate to say it, we're a warm-blooded animal.
Yes.
So they like us because we give off heat.
Yes.
And we tend to feed them.
Yes.
So there is that aspect of it. But to suggest that it's anything more than that, kind of goes against the biology, but I'm not going to fight it. I wouldn't say that, you know, but yeah, I mean, I certainly wouldn't be cuddling up with an alligator or a particularly large python or anything like that anytime soon. So.
Yeah, yeah, or a Komodo dragon for that matter.
No, thank you. No, yeah. But again, it shows what we now know, because, you know, up until, I think, the very late 1800s, it might even be into the 1900s, you could, you know, allow your small child to pet a Komodo dragon at London Zoo.
Yes.
You know, and that was before we understood, you know, that they had venom, that they had, you know, this deadly bite, and all of that. So, but yeah, again, what we now know doesn't seem to have made a huge difference when it comes to some of the things we choose as pets. So
very, very, very true. But you know, it'd be a dull world without that kind of eccentric,
mean,
especially in Britain. We often come across, I remember a very famous video a few years ago of a gentleman in Scotland taking his emu for a walk.
Yeah, and I still it astounds me, and I love it when, you know, no matter where you go, or you, as I say, like coming across a wolf in Portsmouth Harbour, or an emu in Inverness, or whatever it is, you know, but sooner or later you will bump into somebody who has got something, you know, that they basically see as no different as a Labrador, but will quite happily kill you. Yeah.
Very true. We had the tragic death of that gentleman in, was it Florida last year, was it a pet cassowary?
Oh yes, that was that Florida. I'm not sure it was Florida. I know of the case, but I mean, I mean Shannon will be laughing, but yeah, that was it Florida? What a surprise! You know, I mean, again, cassowary. I mean, again, people. You know, we joke, but you know, these are significant, you know, and dangerous animals, and they don't know any difference. And I know I'm basically sounding a bit like Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park now, but you know, it's, you know, nature doesn't understand that it's meant to be a pet, or it's meant to be, domesticated, because, you know, you've got, in some cases, millions of years of instinct. You know, it's one of the reasons I chose big cats in the book as my sort of animal villain as such, because, you know, when you go back to our earliest ancestors, you know, that animal that they were scared of coming out of the darkness at them, the one that they drew on the cave paint, on the cave walls and things like that, was the big cat. You know, and in particular leopards, which are very adept primate killers, you know.
Yes.
I think it's, there's the one of the lower mountain gorilla populations, nearly 30% of them are taken by leopards. One of our earliest fossil sites, which was in North Africa, it was found in a cave where there were leopard fossils. And, you know, again, in the second book, the Daughters of the Darkness, I mention it because it's based on fact, is that, you know, that there were these human skulls, and not far away from it was this leopard skull, and the killing blow to the human skulls was the leopard's tooth, which fit perfectly into it. You know,
yeah.
So we've had this relationship with big cats for millennia, and they've always, you know, whereas, you know, to a certain extent, wolves came and sat with us by the fire. There was always something the other side of the fire we were scared of, and a lot of the time it was big cats.
Yeah, I mean, leopards are ferocious hunters. I've seen a leopard take down a crocodile.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's incredible.
And jaguars in South America, you know, regularly hunting black caiman.
Yeah.
And you know, seriously, you know, making, you know, and again, they're killing bite, you know, Jaguars, they like to, you know, they like to latch onto the back of the skull and put their fangs through the top of the skull. And when you're doing that through a reptile hide and a skull, you know, you need serious biting power to do that. You know, it's
absolutely. I mean, it's one of the other things as well. They're so adept and they're so quick. I once remember watching a documentary about the urbanisation problem of leopards in India. The cities came out, and it was, there were some horrific. It's one of those documentaries where, you know, I've got a fairly strong stomach, but it's one of them where I wish they'd have just said, please be aware, there will be upsetting scenes in this video, because the amount of CCTV footage of leopards coming in and taking domestic pets, dogs especially, was unbelievable. And the dogs were running for their lives because they knew they didn't stand a chance. And it was like off camera, and then next thing, leopard comes past, dragging the dog in its mouth.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think some of the ones as well, which you now see, where leopards are entering, for instance, hotel lobbies,
yes,
and taking sleeping dogs. You know, and things like that are, you know, really quite brutal. And it's one of the things that always gets my attention is that the books are based on reality, because the moment people start reporting missing animals in an area, it gets my, you know, oh, have you seen this dog? Have you seen this cat? You know, it gets my attention because. You know, as you say, New Delhi in particular has this really significant, you know, leopard problem, where they're coming in, and again, they're taking domestic dogs, but also wild dogs and feral dogs, because they've got such huge populations of these, you know, these feral dogs that it makes, you know, they're easy pickings.
Yeah, very much so. But then again, it's that balance, isn't it? It's all about encroachment and, you know, where do you draw the line?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and again, you know, just to show the urbanisation of the leopard, Johannesburg, you know, had a problem leopard.
Yes.
You know, other, you know, one animal. So they set 8 traps up for it across the city. And they caught 8 leopards, you know, and which they didn't know were there. Yeah, so which makes you ask the question: well, how many more are there?
Exactly. Well, they've got the 8 stupid ones.
Yeah. So yeah, they caught the 8. Absolutely, they caught the 8 stupid ones. So you've got to ask yourselves, you know, and when people say, oh, well, we wouldn't, if they were here, we would have seen one, you know, and I'll quote my own book at it, as you could walk right past one, and if it would only know, you would only know it was there if it wanted you to. And, you know, unfortunately, believe me, you did not want it to. It is exactly what they do. They are ambush predators. They've been doing it for, you know, far longer than the human, you know, species has been around, and they'll be doing it for a lot longer. So,
absolutely. Well, listen, just before I wrap this fascinating and extremely interesting conversation up, so thank you again for your time. I just want to finish on probably the one ABC story from the UK that basically convinced me there's something there, which was in 1991, a Eurasian lynx was shot and killed near Norwich in Norfolk, and it had killed 15 sheep within the previous 2 weeks. The story only came to light in 2003, and the alleged stuffed body is now supposedly owned by a collector. For many years, this incident was considered to have been a hoax, particularly by the hunting community, but was confirmed by Norfolk Constabulary as a real incident in March 2006. They believe, but cannot prove, that it was an escapee from a nearby animal facility that bred animals.
Mm.
So that was 14 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's a species that we are currently trying to see reintroduced into the UK.
Yes.
We've hinted already in our chat that, you know, we don't have any apex predators in the UK officially.
yes.
You know, So, yeah, so there is this campaign to bring the lynx back, to help control the deer population,
yep.
And to have an aspect of, you know, a balanced ecosystem. But when you come across, you know, as you say, so that is a perfect example of an animal that used to be hit here, used to be found within our ecosystem, quite very easily fits into it, was denied for several years, mm-hmm. Was used for political propaganda by both sides of the argument, only to basically, once the furore had died down, to be confirmed as something that did happen, that was real, and that was never confirmed to be a domestic animal. And has basically just been, again, you know, and you know, the conspiracy theorists will love it, but has basically been, brushed under the carpet again. So
yeah, I mean, that my biggest theory about all that is that I think that they just can't admit to it happening, because you're going to have one of two things. It's either going to cause lots of panic, or you're just going to get groups of idiots tramping through woods and across dangerous parts of the country, such as Dartmoor and Exmoor and North Yorkshire moors, and places where that, you know, there are things such as quicksand and large crevasses that, you know, Steve and his mates go out on the weekend, you know, big cat hunting, and end up killing themselves by falling down a ravine, Lou.
Yeah.
So I really do think that I've heard enough from farmers, especially, that they believe, they know what a dog attack looks like, and up and down the UK there is something taking these animals that is not a dog.
Oh no, and again, it tends to be, and again, to a certain extent, in the UK, farmers are vilified.
Yes,
And they're made out to be this, you know, sort of the, you know, either money grabbing, or that, you know, they're you know, bigots who are set in their ways. But actually,
yep.
You know, the vast majority of farmers I speak to, they're wildlife orientated, they're conservation orientated. They tend to know their animals, they tend to know their wildlife, and yeah, they're very aware that there are things afoot that do not make sense. And as you say, they know what a dog attack looks like, they'll report a dog attack, and in fact, actually, most of them will quite happily shoot a dog.
Yes.
Because it really is their livelihood at stake.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, what does throw them are these attacks that happen at night, normally in absolute silence, and normally, you know, they only know about it when they discover the animal.
Yes.
And we're talking about numerous incidents where you've had animals, you know, sheep, you know, large animals found in trees, partially buried like pumas do. So they've had their territory marked, they've been covered by brush. And again, they just don't meet the criteria of a dog attack. And again, normally dogs are, as you've seen on any wildlife documentary, when dogs are on the hunt, particularly a feral pack of dogs, they are extremely vocal.
Yes.
You normally know about it. Whereas a lot of these animals are discovered, one of our, the local sort of legends as such around here is the Beast of Blue Water, which is, a large leopard, which is regularly seen anywhere from Gravesend to, you know, the grounds of the shopping centre, hence the Beast of Bluewater.
Yes.
But in Gravesend, not too long ago, in November 2019, a foal was attacked and killed.
Mm.
And there have been, you know, several livestock killings which show signs of asphyxiation. So they've got bulging eyes, they've got their tongue out, as I say, carcasses found in trees. You know, no dog in the world is going to drag anything up a tree. It just isn't. That's cat behavior. So yeah, absolutely, a lot of the time farmers know exactly what they're talking about, and again, if you talk to the police and things like that, who are talking to these people regularly, they take it seriously as well. And again, that's a sign that maybe we should, or certainly should, start taking it seriously. So,
Very much so. Well, listen, thank you very much for joining me today. It's been brilliant to talk to you at last, Luke. We've spoken lots socially online, so it's finally nice to have a proper conversation with you.
It is indeed.
Where can everybody keep up to date with your work, and what else is on your agenda for this year?
Yeah, so, well, you can find me on all the social channels, so Facebook and Instagram in particular. If you look for Black Beast Books, you'll find me. If you look for Luke Phillips, you'll also find me on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. But Black Beast Books is what I tend to go under, and you'll see most activity there. I've got a blog, which is blackbeastsandboogeymen.com. So you'll see some of our more interesting myths and legends on there, from the big grey man and, you know, to, you know, the big cats discussed on there. The two books, Shadow Beast and The Daughters of the Darkness, you can find on Amazon and Audible. Either as a paperback or an ebook, or as I say, as an audiobook. And in terms of what's coming out later this year, I'm hoping to get book three out, which is called Phantom Beast. And my American readers will be very glad to hear that that is set in America, in Wyoming. So a bit more globe-trotting for Thomas Walker, my character. There is also a character in that book called Nina Lee, who gets her own book, which is called Rogue, and I'm hoping to get that out as well by the end of the year. And that will be my first foray into Bigfoot territory. So
marvelous, busy year ahead then, sir.
It does, absolutely. Yeah, I've got to get writing. So
yeah, all right, okay, well, I'll not keep you any longer.
<Very kind.
laughs> Well, listen, thanks again for your time today. It's been lovely to finally have a proper chat with you. All the very best, and keep yourself grounded through what sounds a very busy year to come, my friend.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Paul. And I look forward to hearing many more episodes.
You're very welcome. Take care.
Thank you, Paul.